From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ten years ago, as the Rwandan civil war appeared to be over, the president was assassinated and 800,000 Rwandans were murdered in 100 days. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with General Romeo Dallaire, the commander of the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda, just before and during the genocide. Dallaire was denied authority to intervene militarily. He could only try to negotiate with militia leaders and attempt to protect citizens. In his memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, he writes, "I know there is a God, because in Rwanda, I shook hands with the devil." Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Give, the latest recording by the trio The Bad Plus. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The head of Iraq's U.S.-appointed governing council was assassinated today by a suicide car bomber in Baghdad. Officials say the bomb killed Izzedine Salim and six other Iraqis, including the bomber. A previously unknown group calling itself the Arab Resistance Movement claimed responsibility for the murder in a posting on a website. Salim was the second member of the governing council to be assassinated. He was a Shiite Muslim, and one governing council member said the attack may have been an attempt to trigger sectarian violence in Iraq. U.S. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett told reporters that the bombing fit the pattern of attacks by the terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, but said the U.S. would have to investigate further before determining responsibility. U.S. military officials say soldiers discovered an Iraqi artillery round that contained a small amount of the sarin nerve agent. The discovery could mark the first evidence that weapons of mass destruction remained in Saddam Hussein's possession when U.S.-led forces invaded last year. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Baghdad.
Brigadier General Mark Kimmett told reporters that a convoy discovered a roadside bomb a few days ago that turned out to be an old artillery round of the type Saddam Hussein had told weapons inspectors were destroyed before the 1991 Gulf War. Kimmett said it contained the nerve agent sarin, which can be quickly fatal to humans if sufficiently exposed. Kimmett said the round detonated before it could be disarmed, and two people were treated for what he called minor exposure to the agent. No serious injuries were reported. The discovery was confirmed by the Iraqi Survey Group, in Iraq on assignment to find the weapons of mass destruction the Bush administration used as its primary justification for the war. Kimmett said he suspected the insurgents who planted the bomb had no idea it contained sarin. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Baghdad.
Today, Massachusetts became the first state to permit gay marriage. Across the state, same-sex couples are getting their licenses and saying their vows. NPR's Mike Pesca reports from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Once a couple gets a license, state law requires a 3-day waiting period before the wedding can be officially solemnized. But that period may be waived, and has been many times today. This morning in Northampton, Lise McGinnis was about 50th online at the town clerk's office. She says that marriage will afford her and her partner legal protections.
We've never gotten around to making a will or doing any legal papers so that she could come and see me in the hospital or vice versa.
Despite the objections of Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, some towns are allowing out-of-state couples to wed. In fact, the first couple online in Provincetown was from Alabama. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Amherst, Massachusetts.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 106 points, or more than 1%, to close at 9,907 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 27 to 1,876. This is NPR News. President Bush and his Democratic rival, Senator John Kerry, were both in Topeka, Kansas today to mark the 50th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, the landmark Supreme Court ruling that outlawed segregation in public schools. Kansas Public Radio's Peter Hancock reports.
Half a century after the Brown decision, most public schools in America are desegregated, but President Bush says more still needs to be done for blacks and other minorities to achieve full equality in education.
Justice requires more than a place in a school. Justice requires that every school teach every child in America.
Mr. Bush spoke to about 5,000 people who turned out for ceremonies dedicating one of Topeka's former all-black schools as a National Historic Site commemorating the Brown decision. At a separate appearance, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry voiced similar concerns, but criticized the president for not adequately funding the No Child Left Behind Act, which mandates that all schools close the achievement gap by 2014. For NPR News, I'm Peter Hancock in Topeka.
Pentagon auditors say they're suspending nearly $160 million in meal charges that were billed to the government by a subsidiary of Halliburton Corporation in Iraq. They say they found that Halliburton's Kellogg, Brown, and Root unit submitted incomplete files and bills for the meals. The Pentagon said Halliburton voluntarily removed about $140 million from billings for meals in military dining halls in Iraq in cases where the costs were greater than the number of meals served. With about $6 billion worth of contracts in Iraq, Halliburton is the biggest U.S. contractor. The company was accused of overcharging for gasoline earlier. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, home of 35,000 new jobs, and the new National Air and Space Museum.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It was supposed to be a classic peacekeeping mission when the Canadian general Romeo Dallaire took over the UN observer mission in Uganda and Rwanda. Rwanda was negotiating a peace agreement ending its civil war, but a few months later, in April of 1994, the plane carrying the Hutu president of Rwanda was shot down. Hutu extremists accused the other ethnic group, the Tutsis, of the assassination, and in retribution began a massacre of Tutsis that turned into genocide. An estimated 800,000 Rwandan men, women, and children were murdered in 100 days. Unable to stop the slaughter, General Dallaire remained in Rwanda and tried to protect as many people as he could. In September, he returned home. 4 years later, he testified at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. After that, he says his mind and body decided to give up. Suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder, he was given a medical discharge from the Army in 2000. He's now special advisor to the Canadian government on war-affected children. He describes his recent memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, as a story of betrayal, failure, naivete, indifference, inhumanity, and evil. 10 years after the genocide, we invited him to share his story. Let's go back to when you were first going to Rwanda. Could you just describe what your mission was there?
Well, the mission originally was to command a UN observer mission on the border of Uganda and Rwanda. So I had that mission that was given to me, operating out of the Ugandan side of the border to monitor whether or not equipment was coming in from Uganda to reinforce the rebels. And then subsequently, with the peace agreement being signed in early August, I was given the task of conducting an assessment of whether a UN mission would be plausible to assist the Rwandans in implementing their peace agreement. And then subsequently was given the command of that mission, military command. And my task was to assist in establishing an atmosphere of security with the Rwandans in order to implement their peace agreement. So it was a very classic Chapter 6 force, a neutral force between two ex-belligerents who actually want peace.
So you weren't expecting anything extraordinary, you know, anything out of the ordinary. Not that a peacekeeping mission is ever ordinary, but...
No, but you're quite right. What was expected was a very much a Cyprus scenario in which the will of both sides was very committed to the peace agreement. And they essentially needed a referee there just to make sure that if there is any altercations or any problems that might arise, that somebody neutral is there to assist them in solving it. And that's the essence of a classic Chapter 6 mission.
Now, the genocide started after the president of Rwanda was shot down in his plane on April 6th of 1994. At what point did you realize that the world in Rwanda was about to change?
Oh, well, the workups to the actual event had made the scenario very, very complex and very tense. So we were already in an atmosphere of either a resolution or a blowout, and we were sort of sitting, monitoring both sides and anticipating, hopefully, a positive one, but very much aware that a negative solution might be coming, and that is a humanitarian catastrophe, as we had been informed. And so when the president's plane went down, my first reaction was that the whole mission, the whole scenario is at risk. But it took till the next afternoon, within about 24 hours, when the rebel forces decided to start fighting, that the full realization that the mission formally was now ended and that we were in the middle of a civil war and what looked like something moving away from ethnic cleansing very much towards a genocide.
Do you remember hearing the broadcasts on the radio that urged Hutus to start killing Tutsis?
Well, those broadcasts were given in Kinyarwanda, so they rarely spoke in French or in English, which I speak. And so they were always, when we were able to get the people, finally translated for us. And yes, I still have transcripts of those very explicit instructions given by that extremist radio to people to where to go kill the Tutsis, how to kill them, making sure that they killed the children, because the rebels that are attacking now are the children of those that they had killed in the 50s, but had omitted to kill those children.
General Dallaire, you write in your book, commanders spend their careers preparing for the moment when they will have to choose between lose-lose propositions in the use of their troops. Regardless of the decision they make, some of their men will almost certainly die. You had one of those lose-lose decisions at the beginning of the genocide. Would you describe the decision you had to make?
Well, it was a decision that when I was going to a meeting to retake stock with the military commanders and those who at the time we believe we had been moving a coup d'etat that ultimately was going to move to the ultimate plan of the mass killings, I went by one of the military camps and saw a couple of my soldiers who were laying on the ground 50, 60 meters away. And being prevented from stopping there, I went to the meeting, and it became quite obvious to me that the bulk of my force was vulnerable and that we are actually now becoming potential targets. And that in that light, I had to either decide to go and rescue those soldiers that may still be alive in that camp, or negotiate for them to come to life and try to bring my forces into a position to be more secure.
What did you decide to do?
Well, I decided to negotiate because I didn't have the forces, because we were Chapter 6, deployed to be able to go and conduct a counterattack. And at the lower levels, they attempted it and got nowhere. And my decision was, is we'll negotiate, because the potential of more casualties was much higher than the potential of saving those who were in that camp.
So were you successful at getting your men out of this camp?
No, the 10 soldiers that were in that camp ultimately were slaughtered.
After 10 of your men were massacred, how did it affect what you thought you should be doing with the men who remained? How did it affect what you thought your mission should be?
Well, at that time, until the end of that day, my mission was to try to continue to prevent that the rebel forces would ultimately launch their offensive. And then what would I have? I would have had both ex-belligerents going back to war, and as such, there was no peacekeeping mission. Now, when that actually happened, I had two options. One option was to remain and to assist as much as we could with these crimes against humanity that was happening, to continue to convince or try to work out truces and peace ceasefire negotiations, and ultimately to prevent whatever we could do, the genocide, and protect as many Rwandans as we could. The other option is not having any mandate, and New York giving me no mandate, and the countries that had given the not given, in fact, lent the troops to the UN under my command, had lent them only for a peacekeeping mission, classic. My orders should have been technically to simply order all my troops to hunker down and implement the evacuation plan.
And what did you do?
I requested reinforcements. By the end of the second day, we had over 20,000 Rwandans under our protection. And so I decided that we would stay and protect them, continue to negotiate to get a ceasefire. However, because we were low on food, water, supplies, and ammunition, and because the nations like Belgium and others, Bangladesh and so on, had ordered their troops out or not to do anything, I essentially, by the fourth, fifth day, was a commander of about 800 soldiers, which were principally the Ghanaians and the Tunisians and some observers.
And that was down from a force of about 4,000?
No, 2,600.
2,600, okay.
Yeah. And even at that, the Ghanaians arrived with no equipment. They simply don't have the equipment to do the job. I received orders then to totally pull out the force, which I refused. And because there was no cavalry and no resources to even sustain the forces I had, and I was taking casualties from mortar and artillery fire and stuff like that, I recommended that reduce my force to the minimum of about 270 to 300 troops so we can continue to protect. Now, by then, we had over 30,000 people, and also continue the ceasefire negotiations and be a foot on the ground if we finally decide to give me reinforcements.
My guest is General Romeo Dallaire. His new memoir is called Shake Hands with the Devil, The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general who headed the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda just before and during the genocide 10 years ago. At what point did you realize that what was happening in Rwanda went beyond civil war, that it was actually turning into genocide?
Well, by the fourth day in that ballpark, we had seen that the political decapitation had ebbed. In fact, Literally, all moderates, Tutsi or Hutu leaders of any sort, were targeted, and they had been on lists, and the extremists knew exactly where they lived, had targeted them and went in and killed the bulk of them with their families, with some of them escaping, and some of them we were able to get out. And then the killings continued, and by then the term ethnic cleansing was very much in use. I had already sent from my previous command troops to Yugoslavia and so on. So that was what we thought was evolving. And it took, in fact, right up to around the 26th that I finally agreed with the ICRC, the International Red Cross representative, as we discussed this absolutely catastrophic continuum of slaughter, that we were in the middle of a genocide. And it took that long because, to me, genocide was equivalent to Holocaust. That's how we had been educated. And so I just couldn't imagine a Holocaust. And so it took time to finally grasp the fact that this was a genocide, and we had to influence the international community accordingly.
What did you do with the limited, with the small number of troops that you had to actually protect, you said, about 30,000 people?
Well, we had five sites that were strong sites, like the National Stadium, hospital, and so on. But it was far more by the realization of the extremists that although they're massacring and killing, and I'd hope we all leave so that they wouldn't have witnesses, we were staying, and that it behooved them to tread lightly on coming in and killing the people in our protected sites, although there were altercations also with the rebels because we were protecting Hutus also. And that dominated a lot of our work. Just to try to feed them, give them water, medical supplies. Here we were protecting people, and in the same time they were dying because we couldn't get anything to them. My soldiers were getting sick because they couldn't eat or drink water because they were surrounded all the time by these Rwandans who had nothing. So it got complex on that side. The other side is I continued to negotiate ceasefires and also provide troops in order to go and save people that we had received requests through the UN. Although the French, the Belgians, the Italians, and the Americans had evacuated nearly all of the white population in the first days of the war, there were still many remaining, and also the bulk of the Rwandans who had helped these people were still on the ground. And so we were sending out patrols, risking their lives to try to save these people.
Much of the genocide in Rwanda was carried out with machetes. How did the fact that that's the way so many of the murders were being accomplished, how did that affect your mission in terms of what you needed to do to protect people, in terms of what the medical needs of the people around you were like? And
It's one of the most horrific ways of killing people. In regards to young children, it's very effective because their heads come off rapidly or they can cut them in two. But with adults, you got to hack and slash a couple times. And these extremists, the militias and so on, at times were drugged up or boozed up and had been killing all day. So it's very fatiguing. And so what they resorted to is, instead of ensuring the people were dead, is that they injured them enough that they were immobile and that they would bleed to death. And so ultimately what happened is that you had people literally dying over days in the heat and or in the thrown still alive but suffering in latrines and situations like that, or thrown into the water injured and still alive, not able to save themselves. And those scenarios created incredible moral dilemmas in as much as there was in large parts of Rwanda up to 30% of HIV/AIDS before the war started, and soldiers don't run around with rubber gloves. And so the blood was all over the place, and to what extent do those soldiers expose themselves in helping people to contracting HIV/AIDS? And it was interesting that the bulk of the forces that I had responded that they would not put their lives of their soldiers at risk in trying to save these people in any way, shape, or form. Because of HIV/AIDS, but a few countries said that AIDS or no AIDS, if people are suffering, their guys would go in.
What was your view of that? What did you think was the appropriate position for the troops to take?
Well, three contingents made it quite clear that they would intervene. The Dutch contingent, a Ghanaian contingent. Ghanaian army had been trained by the Canadians since their freedom or their independence in 1962, and the Canadians. And so in one case, there was a test case of one of those contingents, and the officer wasn't even able to give an order either to go in or not to save these people. The troops themselves were in helping the people.
Could you have gotten a shipment of rubber gloves from the UN?
I couldn't even get ammunition.
You couldn't get food. What am I thinking? Yeah.
There was nothing coming in. We had been totally and completely abandoned. The only people that were left there were some Red Cross with some Médecins Sans Frontières and the limited forces that I had left, which were mostly Tunisian, and some Franco-African officers and Ghanaians. And there was absolutely nothing. We ran out of food and water and medical supplies ourselves.
Early in the genocide, there was a radio station that was exhorting its listeners to kill Tutsis. A little later into the genocide, one of the people on the radio, I believe, was exhorting its listeners to kill you. And I think they were identifying you as the white man with the mustache.
Yes.
What can you tell us about what was actually said in the broadcast?
Well, the broadcast indicated that I, through my work, was sympathetic to the rebels, and that, in fact, wherever I went, the rebels would be following within a week or two. And the reason that they used that is the fact that whenever I met with the extremist leaders, they were so terrible in defending their positions in the Civil War part of it, is that they would often be overrun by the RPF. And so the radio simply made it clear that people, if they saw me, should kill me because I was essentially working for the other side. And so when that came out, I had still some white officers, and some of them had mustaches, Europeans, and they all started to become targets, and people had to fight off mobs and the like, so I had to order their evacuation just for their own safety.
Because they were white and had mustaches?
Yeah, and they looked a bit like me, and it was close enough for the mob.
Did you shave?
No.
Really? Why not? If they're looking for a mustache, why not take it off?
No, there was no way that I was going to camouflage myself. In fact, I never even changed a uniform to be in combat uniform. I remained in my dress that I always had even before the war. I wore a flak jacket, and then because of the threat, I was ordered to carry a pistol. I would not always go in my 4x4. I would, at times, depending on where I was going, use an APC, though.
What's an APC?
An armored personnel carrier.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did anyone come close to fulfilling the command to kill you?
Yes.
What happened?
I'm not going to talk about it.
General Romeo Dallaire commanded the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda just before and during the genocide. He'll be back in the second half of the show. His memoir is called Shake Hands with the Devil. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Shaking Hands with the Devil, we continue our conversation with General Romeo Dallaire, the commander of the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda 10 years ago during the genocide. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest recording by The Bad Plus. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general who led the UN peacekeeping mission in Rwanda just before and during the genocide. Last month, he returned to Rwanda on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the genocide. He's written a memoir called Shake Hands with the Devil, in which he describes his predicament during the massacres, commanding a few hundred soldiers who were allowed to use their weapons only in self-defense. They were surrounded by murdering mobs, cut off from the rest of the world. Would you be comfortable talking about the feeling, the kind of dual feeling of responsibility and helplessness? When you are trying to protect people and there are, you know, a few hundred men under your command who you want to protect as well, and yet the circumstances are so extreme that it's really impossible to ensure anybody's protection.
Well, one night, within the first 10 days of the war starting, we had one in particular with a couple moderate leaders in my headquarters. And the troops I had at that point defending the headquarters were far from being the most effective troops. And so on one night, as I was walking around the perimeter defenses and on the roof of the headquarters, pitch black out, fighting had been going on in the areas between the rebels and the elite paracommandos of the extremists who were trying to get at my headquarters to get these guys out. It came upon me this feeling of a bit like Gordon of Khartoum, where you had been totally abandoned. I mean, there was no desire to come and reinforce you whatsoever. You were exceptionally limited, not only in quality of troops and quantity, but also in resources to be able to sustain any operation. And so you were simply left abandoned to a survival situation. And that got worse a couple nights later when our communications were shot out. And so there were absolutely no communications whatsoever with the outside world. Totally abandoned by the world. And so you could either live that despair and pray that nobody attacked, or as a commander, take heart in the fact that you still have a command and that the responsibilities to protect were still there, and encourage your troops to feel the same way and motivated to do so.
I'm assuming that what you did is the latter.
Well, in fact, that's what we did for, I never got the reinforcements until after the war.
What do you think the rest of the world could have done? You said the world abandoned you. You had no connection at all with the outside world. What do you think could have been done to help the troops and to help the people who were being massacred?
Well, before the actual war for about 3 months, the world or the bodies of decision knew the incredibly high risks of this peacekeeping mission failing, and that we would be faced with a catastrophic failure because we had had an informant that described exactly ultimately what happened. But there was absolutely no will in anybody to either send us troops nor to change the mandate to permit me to curtail the actions of the extremists in their training, distribution of arms, and the like. And so for those 3 months, no one was interested in giving me more capability to prevent the genocide of the Civil War to be launched. Once it was launched, then nations that have the capability of deploying troops rapidly to destroy right at the essence the destructive forces, the militias, so that it wouldn't propagate throughout the country, and in fact we would stop the killing very rapidly. Those countries that deliberately took decisions not to intervene. I mean, the Americans on the morning of the 7th of April were barely 12 hours into this situation in the Security Council in their working room, told everybody that not only were they not going to intervene, but they were going to help nobody who wanted to. And when I had up to four Franco-African countries already to send me troops, but they couldn't get there because there was no strategic lift, and once on the ground, they had no equipment. It was a deliberate actions that Rwanda and Rwandans simply don't count. because as that's going on, we're pouring tens of thousands of troops and billions of dollars into ex-Yugoslavia. And the question is how come one gang get all that support and the other gang gets nothing? And what we saw in the lack of depth of the media, they came in to take the pictures of the gore, but absolutely had no depth into why this was happening and why it was significant, in as much as they turned it into banal tribalism. And it was not tribalism. It was people, extremists, who didn't want to give up power, didn't want to share power, and aligned themselves in a way that they were going to eliminate the potential enemy, which happened to be in one particular tribal group. So as we banalize Rwanda, it's of no strategic value, geography, no strategic value, resources, it's only got tea and coffee. And as one officer told me, he said the only thing in Rwanda are humans, and there's already too many of them. It's overpopulated. And so as we banalize that and don't want to get involved in a very messy situation in Rwanda with blacks in Africa killing each other, Yugoslavia, that's different. This is more sophisticated. You know, these are great religions who have been in friction for so long, and their ethnicities have evolved. People have studied it. You've got the Ottoman Empire impact. Oh, yes, and they were allies in Second World War, and we know some of them. And so they're very important. And the fact that they were in Europe makes them only more important, and ultimately probably because they were white made them that important. And that's why the Yugoslavia got everything. And in Rwanda, we pulled everything out. And so ultimately, there were more people killed, injured, internally displaced and refugeed in 100 days in Rwanda than the 6 years of the Yugoslavian campaign. And nobody came nor cared.
Even though the former Yugoslavia got much more in the way of military support and other support from Western countries, the role of peacekeepers, of UN peacekeepers there, has been questioned by many people. I'm wondering, just from your experience in Rwanda, what do you think we need to be rethinking about the role of peacekeepers and the resources that we give them?
Well, I think the first thing is to get the big powers out of the business and get the middle powers to pull their weight through the UN, always through the UN, because there is no single nation-led coalition that will have the transparency or the impartiality of the UN, even with its warts. And so the big powers, instead of attriting their combat capabilities and their strength through the threat of use of their strength, they are, in fact, going into these operations and becoming very vulnerable and ultimately risking the rest of the operation. Certainly Americans in Black Hawk Down in Somalia is a perfect example. And even today in Baghdad or in Iraq, seeing U.S. forces deployed there after they had fought their way to Baghdad, I think is the most catastrophic scenario. What the peacekeepers today require is a whole set of new skills based on far more an intellectual basis than the pure warrior ethic that is trying to be watered down. And so what we're looking for today is, in fact, people who can be warriors but also have the intellectual depth to be able to be conflict resolvers. And so be value-added and be in the alleyways and talking with the people and helping them resolve the problems. And so that's why we want the officers, particularly in middle powers, to have skills and knowledge, particularly in anthropology and sociology and philosophy, so they can grasp the complexities of this era. Because this era is not like before. The post-Cold War era of conflict is exceptionally complex. It is incredibly ambiguous. And generals who run around the countryside saying that they shouldn't go in unless they have clear mandates and extra strategies and they're fearful of mission creep are people who are living in the wrong era. The era is to function in such complex scenarios with this ambiguity. And what is missing is, how do we maneuver in this? Do we have the right tools and do we have the right doctrines and concepts? Throughout NATO, during the Cold War, we had lexicons of action verbs, you know, to attack, defend, and all that kind of stuff. And everybody knew exactly what it meant, including the enemy knew exactly what it meant. However, in 1993, when I was given my mission to Rwanda, it was to assist in establishing an atmosphere of security. Now, where do I find the solution to that? Right. To what extent do I expose my troops? Do I actually defend that country while I'm demobilizing both sides against another party? And so in that vacuum of real clear definitions, or at least definitions that give you the ballpark in which you want to maneuver, people are reverting to Cold War methodologies, and we have been ad hocking it, on-job training, crisis managing, and not being providing much value added to solving problems.
My guest is General Romeo Dallaire. His new memoir is called Shake Hands with the Devil, The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general who headed the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda just before and during the genocide 10 years ago. General Dallaire, your book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is about your experiences leading the peacekeeping troops, the UN peacekeeping troops in Rwanda just before and during the genocide. The title again is Shake Hands with the Devil. In your book you write, in Rwanda I shook hands with the devil, so I know there is a God. I know the devil exists, and therefore I know there is a God. Who is the devil? Do you think of the devil that you shook hands with as being one person or more of a group phenomenon?
Well, there was one person in particular, and in fact there were his sort of sidekicks in the militia leaders. I had to negotiate with these guys, although I had an option also shooting them between the eyes, but I'm not sure that would have provided anything, for their structures were so strong as that they would have replaced them, and then the whole force would have been again vulnerable. But what I saw in those people, in their eyes, was not the eyes of human beings, it were the eyes of evil. And I call it the devil because that my religion sort of qualifies us at that. And they were the devil. They were the evil. They had blood on their shirts. I mean, they could negotiate with me with no passion whatsoever, simply saying, yeah, okay, we'll stop massacring here so that you can move, people between the lines for about 2 hours, and then we'll start up again. And so the human beings don't talk of that nature. It is another entity. Even their hands were cold, but it was like a death cold. Death cold is not a temperature, it's a state. And so I was absolutely talking, negotiating, and touching what I would qualify as the most evil, and it is the devil. And in the same vein, there's at least one occasion, one particular, where something happened. In my office, I was stood there alone one night, that moved me from a scenario of we've had it, to a scenario that we were going to sustain ourselves one way or another, and we were going to stay, and we were going to do everything we could.
What happened?
In fact, I was standing at the window, and the lights were off, and there was a sort of a breeze or a sense that came through the window. And I just felt some presence. It's sort of like a vibration or something. And my whole thought process shifted at that moment. And so the whole ideas of evacuation or whatever that stuff went out the window with the breeze, I suppose.
Did you consider that to be something of a religious vision?
I sensed that there was this positive force that in my religion, Judeo-Christian religion, says it's God. Well, okay, it'll be God. But these entities do exist.
So you did feel that night that what you were experiencing was the presence of God?
There was no doubt. And there is no doubt today.
When you were meeting with the men who you came to think of as the devil,
Yes.
You said you could have shot them between the eyes, but it probably wouldn't have done any good. Was there ever a moment where you thought, maybe I should shoot them between the eyes? And was the moment when you thought maybe they'd shoot you between the eyes? Because certainly you were their enemy.
In fact, it's interesting that on one occasion I actually took all the bullets out of my pistol and made sure I didn't have them available in one of my meetings with them because of some of the sights I'd been seeing that day and the night before. Them shooting me, on the contrary, the fact that I was meeting with them to negotiate the transfer of people between the lines gave them a great sense of importance. They were actually meeting the general of the UN. I mean, he wants to see us, militia leaders, and not just the extremist generals. To them, it was a high point.
You emptied out your gun because you were afraid you would shoot them if you didn't do that?
Well, certainly the emotional position was that strong.
You write in your book that 4 years after you got home from Rwanda, your mind and body decided to give up. Mm-hmm. What happened to you 4 years later?
Well, I had been testifying in the International Tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania. I had been attempting to work myself to death, and ultimately my physical condition, because I wasn't sleeping, nor was I able to sustain myself with healthy food or anything like that, and just driving my mind all the time, fearing, sleeping, and continuously invaded by scenes that were coming back in clear digital color and so on. It got to a point where that whole weight just collapsed. And when the chief of defense staff asked me how I was doing on that particular day, and it had been quite a busy day, I said I was tired, and he said, well, why don't you take a month's leave? Then I simply broke down, and it took about 7 months before I was able to even start reading the newspaper.
Do you feel yourself again?
Oh, much, much better. I'm sort of like the person who suffers of diabetes. They got to take their insulin every day, and I take a few pills every day to make sure that things are stable and I can sleep. And I go about my business now much stronger because I've been back to Arusha for the principal génocidaire and testified. The book is out, so people know, and I don't have the weight of that story still on me. My children will know the story much clearer through that book. And I recently have returned from Rwanda from seeing it after 10 years. So all that has moved me quite positively.
Tell me if you think this is true or not. It strikes me that you're in a real paradoxical situation. You were there in Rwanda trying to protect people at a time when most of the world had chosen to ignore what was happening. And because you were there and because you felt so responsible, you probably also feel guilty, although what could you possibly have done that you didn't do? So it seems that in a way, because you were the person who didn't turn your back, because you were the person who was there, you're also the person who feels this horrible responsibility that you should have done more, because you were in the center of it.
Yeah, rather a Greek story, isn't it? The things that I have been educated in my military and so many other militaries, true professional militaries, is the fact that when you are a commander, when you are in command, then you are held responsible for the success or failure of your mission. And my mission was to assist the Rwandans to move to a peace agreement, and it failed. Now, many people have told me, yeah, but you did what you could and so on. There is absolutely no solace in the fact that you can turn around and say, I did what I could, when there's 800,000 people who have been killed around you. You've lost soldiers, the country has been disseminated, and millions have been suffering. So in the first instance, there is a continuous and will be everlasting sense of guilt of having failed that mission. And secondly, the inability to influence the international community, no matter what I did in regards to using the media, was just not enough. I just did not influence the world to realize the extent of what was happening, and that is a responsibility that you have in the field.
You went back to Rwanda for the 10th anniversary of the genocide.
Yes.
How did the country look to you, and was it helpful to you personally to go back there and see how the country had changed?
Well, I'm not sure if it's helpful in the full sense, because it seemed to be I was a bit zombie-esque. But the country is in much better shape. The beauty of it is still there. The warmth of many of the Rwandans is there, but very few friends have survived. And so it was a bit lonely on that side. And whenever I was looking at these sites all rebuilt, what was coming like a teleprompter in front of my eyes were the scenes in fast forward of what they looked like during the genocide. So it was good to touch base, but I don't think the shoe has dropped yet on its full impact on me.
General Dallaire, thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate you reflecting with us on your experiences. Thank you. Yeah. And I wish you all the best.
Well, you're very kind, and your questions were excellent.
Romeo Dallaire commanded the UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda just before and during the 1994 genocide. His memoir is called Shake Hands with the Devil. Photos of survivors and reports from the genocide are at the website npr.org. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by The Bad Plus. This is Fresh Air. In 2002, the piano, bass, and drums trio The Bad Plus put out a CD including ABBA's Knowing Me, Knowing You and Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. Last year, they released the breakout sequel These Are the Vistas, featuring Smells Like Teen Spirit and Blondie's Heart of Glass. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he likes one thing about their new album right off. They don't do Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Bad Plus, you may have read, is making jazz relevant again by renewing its links to contemporary pop. Boosters say it's not just that they cover Black Sabbath and the Pixies, as they do on their new CD Give, but that they totally rock. I've seen them wow a college-age crowd in concert, and I like the idea of a jazz trio that punches it out like, oh, Little Richard or the Sex Pistols. But is this really it? That's the classic Bad Plus sound. They're not your father's jazz trio, one reviewer cheers, but shouldn't a reputed power trio rock harder than Dad's old copy of Gary Wright's Dreamweaver? Granted, you can simulate rock using sledgehammer drums and a tune that goes nowhere, but why forego the propulsive beat and interpretive leeway rock took from jazz? The band sounds better when they remember that stuff. Thank you. Cheney Pinata by pianist Ethan Iverson, with a tip of the hat to 1968 Keith Jarrett. Iverson is a gifted jazz player who knew next to zilch about rock when the Bad Plus formed, and in some ways, he's still an awkward fit. When he wants to make a splash here, he sounds like a classical pianist acting out a second childhood. There are a couple of tunes when the Bad Plus are playful and stick close to the melody and fire it up. Bassist Reed Anderson has a pliant sound and a good beat. Lead-footed drummer David King is no swinger, but he did write the liveliest tune on the new CD, Layin' a Strip for the Higher Self State Line. That's a better Bad Plus, aspiring to the high ensemble ideals set by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Trouble with Girls, stories about the romantic education of an ordinary guy looking for love by Marshall Boswell. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with William Kristol, editor of the conservative magazine The Weekly Standard and chair of the Project for the New American Century, which advocated regime change in Iraq even before September 11th. We'll ask Kristol for his impressions of Iraq today. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.